This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I want to talk about community-based participatory research, a little bit about social marketing and how it's a tool that we can use in healthcare and education that we have perhaps not fully realized or utilized to date, and then talking about how we have a lot of friendships and partners in the community that we may not reach out to, such as local media, radio stations, and so forth, to help us do our work. So the title of this talk says Closing the Gap, and that brings us to the question of what gap and who is missing. So Marion Wright Edelman, who founded the Children's Defense Fund and has been an advocate and leader in children's issues and advocacy for decades and decades, funded a study to find out who is missing. I'm going to let you guys think about these three dates and think back in history and see if you can come up with when this study was funded. The who is missing from schools? Well, when Marion Edelman Wright set out to advocate at the Senate to get funding to do this study about who's missing from schools, she fully expected that it would be minorities, specifically African-American children from the South. When they did the 1970 census, they found that there was a disparity between the number of children that were being reported in households and the number of children in school of over a million children missing, not in school. Well, much to her surprise, it turned out that 750,000 of these children were missing from school because they were, quote unquote, handicapped. This was a pretty big revelation to her advocacy group, and to many people in the United States. And it was a knockout punch. Wow. So if you're familiar with her work, you know there's no way that she just looked at these numbers and did nothing. So she proceeded to lead the charge along with many other groups. And in 1975, this answer to the question of who is missing resulted in the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. And we've come a long way since then. This is the precursor to IDEA and even the more recent legislation that we have for accessibility, quality, and equity in schools for all children. However, we're now at 2012, and we still have children missing. And who are these children? Well, 17% of all children in the general population experience some type of disability. And about 3.8 million people have developmental disabilities in the U.S. These numbers still are inconsistent with what we would expect to see based on educational census and special ed numbers. There's a discrepancy. There is a gap there. Who's missing? In addition, we have little to non-existent data on disabilities within marginalized communities. So these are ethnic minorities that we don't track for many reasons, health or otherwise, but we certainly don't track their presence in schools, especially if they are multiply marginalized, meaning they have a developmental disability of some sort and belong to a non-counted ethnic community. These are often referred to in the literature as multiply marginalized, hard-to-reach or hardly-reached communities. So we've come a long way, and I'm here today to talk about and make the case that we still have a long way to go and to maybe provide some solutions. When working with communities, especially communities that have English as not their first language, it's very important to think about terminology and usage and looking at this from a global perspective, because many of our community members come from all around the world. And terms that are commonly used are impairment, disability, and handicapped. The United Nations World Health Organization actually implements all three of these terms and uses them on a spectrum, if you will, with impairment meaning mostly physical disabilities, access to full utility of life and work, a disability being something that could be medically treated or corrected, and a handicap meaning that you don't have the experience of full activities and functionality for activities of daily living. These things mean very different things to various groups of people, and there are advocates that argue strongly in many directions about what might be a good term or the best term or the most appropriate term or the most compassionate term when trying to organize and think about these issues. So in Europe, particularly the United Kingdom and through many parts of Russia, the preferred usage and governmental term is impairment. They don't look favorably upon the term disability and handicap. In the United States, we're settling, at least currently, using the term disability, and the United Nations World Health Organization is using the word disability. So that is the terminology that I will use today. There are also various definitions in our own American with Disabilities Act. There is a different definition in the Act than there is in the regulations, which I think is pretty interesting. Social Security uses a different definition, and the American Medical Association uses yet a different definition. So if you're reaching out to a community and you want to say, we'd like to know about disabilities and how those are experienced in your community, you have to begin the discussion with what are you talking about to begin with, and what's your common philosophy, what's your common ground, how are you going to think about these issues? In addition to terminology, model of disability is also important in how things are going to be addressed and services provided. For many years, we have defined legally disabilities related to more of a medical model influence. This is the traditional healthcare model, and this is where disabilities are seen as something that can and or should be treated or cured. The social model really emerged very strongly in Europe in the late 80s and into the early 90s, and I think took a very strong foothold with the American Disabilities Act of 1990 in the United States. And this reframes issues of disability into the social perspective. So I can do anything everybody else can do if the social environment accommodates or supports what needs to be done, that full accessibility should be available for everybody. And I'll give you some examples about that in a minute. More recently, we moved into an interactional model, and this is the biopsychosocial model. This is the one that I'm glad to say, at least we're using in nursing schools in California. I certainly know UC Davis uses this to frame medical care and moving away from that more traditional medical model. But thinking about how persons interact with the environment, looking at an interactive dynamic between families, communities, environments, and accessibility. Models of disability, however, when you begin to talk about these with other communities, can be kind of interesting, because when I first started working with the Hmong community and we were having our philosophical talks about terminology and models and kind of how we wanted to think about disabilities, what they said was, there's no reason for us to talk about this. I want to go to the doctor and I want to be cured. And it was very clear. Not much wiggle room there. And it was a learning experience, I think, on both of our parts to begin to take a step back and say, let's talk about framing and modeling and potential in life and work together to think about what services could be offered and what needs to change in the environment. So to make these things more clear, I thought I would talk with you a little bit about how we gather data related to disabilities. And in the United States, Health and Human Services does a national healthcare survey, and they just randomly call people up and say, how's your health? And then they start getting into these questions. That same exact thing happens in the United Kingdom and in many of the industrial countries. And how you model, frame, or think about disabilities is going to point the direction in how these questions are asked. So from the UK, does your health problem or disability prevent you from going out as often or as far as you would like? Same question in the United States. Do you have serious difficulty walking or climbing stairs? Recommended questioning from disability advocacy groups, particularly Michael Oliver in the UK. What is it about the local environment that makes it difficult for you to go out in your neighborhood? So I think you can begin to get a feeling for the model or the framework that's driving these questions, and also how you as a consumer may experience these questions and develop points of view, even about yourself, because of how the healthcare system is treating you or asking you about your disability. Some further examples. United States. Are you deaf or do you have serious hearing difficulty? Recommended from Michael Oliver. Are your difficulties in understanding people mainly due to their inability to communicate with you? One frames you have the problem. The other says we can all share in helping things get better. Does your health problem or disability affect your work in any way? It's from the UK. Recommended. Do you have problems at work because of the physical environment or the attitudes of others? Interesting to note that the United States HHS survey doesn't even address work or workability in asking about disability. There's actually a presumption that work may be off the plate and we're not going to inquire about it at all. So thinking about working with communities, multiply marginalized communities, it's important to drive down terminology, it's important to drive down framework, and it's important to think about how you ask questions. The United Nations has, for at least a decade, encouraged the global healthcare world to look at functional definitions of health, including health-related matters to disability. The United States has not in any way framed this or taken this up yet. They just actually revised the adult functional assessment to include children, so I think that's a step in the right direction. But the U.S. and the CDC and our recommended guidelines don't do that. We are not yet teaching our doctors and nurses how to do health assessments based on functionality, very much still driven by that medical model. So in many of the projects and things that I've done with advocates in the communities for developmental disabilities, these rights get talked about a lot. And I think everybody in the room today wants to work on those rights. So where are we in the United States? Well, this was brought forward by the World Health Organization, the UN, in 2007. You can see in the UK they adopted it in 2007 and finally ratified it in 2009. So right now in the U.S., July 12, 2012, we have made it through one Senate committee. So the Foreign Relations Committee has approved this. It was a battle. Thank goodness that we have lots of advocates every single day up on the Hill trying to ensure these rights for persons in the United States. Fortunately, many countries are on this, and the United Nations website actually has probably 12 different marketing videos that you can share with groups to talk about rights. And when we started our work with the Hmong community, which I'll describe in a little bit, this is the framework that we started with. We said, these are the rights. These are the things that we want to have happen. These are the hopes and the potentials of a person with disabilities, and they have them now from Africa and several other places. So all of this brings us back to this question now, who's still missing? And I'd like to share with you some experiences that I've had as a nurse within the last year. At Sac State, I'm the coordinator of the school nurse credential program, so I have the honor and privilege of educating school nurses, nurses to obtain their credential all over the state. 2 weeks ago, a student called me up and said, I have a problem, Professor Baker. I have a six-year-old girl with spina bifida. Her mother is Hispanic and doesn't speak English. And the school told her she has to come to work every single day to catheterize her child. I said, oh, well, that's not legal. We kind of always think that, well, that's not right. That's not the rules. That's not the law. She said, yeah. And the reason why she called me, she finally got to the school nurse, was because she was going to lose her job. She couldn't get to there, to lunch and back and get this done. And she was afraid because she said they're going to kick her child out of school. She said, what do you mean kick her out of school? Well, right now she's going to her local school. If I don't do this, she's going to have to go to that other school where they put all the children with disabilities. I don't want my daughter at that school. So how do you begin the discussion about rights and activities and what should happen with that mom? The school nurse even told me, says, I'm afraid. What are you afraid about? I'm afraid to go in and tell my principal. I get funded based on his budget. And if I ruffle feathers too much, they won't have a school nurse at this school at all. And there's going to not be anybody here to advocate for anyone. She goes, you know what it's like at those IEP meetings. I was like, oh. So that was a big discussion. In one of our local school districts, we were examining some data from California Required Hearing Screening and discovered that 30% of the children that failed their hearing screening were Hmong. Went back and looked at the IEP data and found out that many had been enrolled in communication, special enrollment, and so forth. And also many were diagnosed with a diagnosis of selective mutism. So what's going on there? Is that a cultural issue? Is there a genetic issue? Why the hearing loss? What's up? How many of them had received follow-up for their medical care appointments after having the hearing screen failed? Less than 5%. That they all ended up in special education. So what was going on there? I made a home visit fairly recently to a man who had a 21-year-old son who required total care. It's believed that his son is also deaf and blind, and he does everything. He has refused services from Alta. He has refused a lift to help with toileting. His wife has left him. The other children in the household have left him, and he's there all day. In having further discussions with him, the question came up, what's the issue? Well, if I accept help from my son, they're going to take away my welfare benefits because they're going to think my family's become too dependent on the state. And it's either I take care of him or we lose everything. Now, we know that that's not the case, but that was the understanding that he was left with. And that's not to say that I'm not even talking about these things in terms of fault. What I'm saying is there's systems issues, there's missing issues, there's things that are happening that we don't always clearly understand. So since the time that I served on the area board and for the last 30 years, this question of what's been missing, who's missing, has been nagging me for a while. And I was really, really fortunate to be able to be invited to be faculty at the Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. And it gave us some resources and time to start digging into some data. I was particularly interested in the Southeast Asian community because they were, at the time, some of the most recent immigrants in our area and actually remain so today. So we looked at special education rates, state level rates for regional centers, and found out that they had much lower referral rates for Southeast Asian than any other ethnic group, despite not representing the lowest percentage of population. And then even when referrals were made, services are accepted. Actual expenditures for vendored services were much lower for Southeast Asian clients. So there was a gap. There was a disparity, and it gave us this kind of impetus to look a little further. We focused particularly on education, although certainly keeping in mind the context of the entire lifespan and workability and transition issues, because as I just pointed out, disability may be the most important single factor excluding children from school in the United States as well as worldwide. We know that education is the single most important factor to reduce inequities for both health and fiscal stability, and that education is more than access. It also includes equity and quality. So if we were going to start on this issue of who's missing and who's missing from services and vendored services and where the marginalization is going to occur, a nice place to start might be the educational institutions and systems. So I'm going to now talk about a very specific community, the Hmong community in this greater Sacramento region, and some work that we've been able to do through the SED to help, we hope, find the missing and start closing these gaps. I would like to acknowledge that Dr. Elizabeth Miller, Mi Ying Lee, Dr. Chim Sang Yang, and Dr. Michelle Dang also worked on these studies with me, even though they're not here today to share. Whenever you begin to ground a project, it's nice to ground it in your institution's values, and it's the same way that we begin to talk about the values for disabilities and so forth. And at the SED, these are their core values. I want you to particularly notice partnership and reducing disparities. So with those two things in mind, Dr. Hansen said to Dr. Miller and myself, go out. Find partnerships in the community and go out and do work to reduce disparities. So that's what we set out to do. There's also an excellent community advisory committee that we report to regularly through the SED, and they've been following and monitoring these issues, very important issues with us, for the last 5 years. So when we dug deeper, we found out that Asian Pacific Island American populations were underrepresented. They have 16% of the regional center referrals in Northern California, and overall, Northern California represented about 11% of the population. They're about 17% of the population in Sacramento. Even with the referrals, so once the referrals get made, there's a very low number of IEPs and services. So somewhere between referral and actual evaluation through the IEP process, we figured out we were losing about 6 to 7% of the kids. It's quite a bit. The Hmong experience inequities in many, many areas, including disabilities, and this is despite the fact that they've been in the United States for about 40 years now. So they've been a persistent group for which disparities have not diminished at all, and this is fairly unique for an ethnic minority immigrant pattern in the United States. One of the reasons for this is that we only have 6 ethnic census categories in the United States, so we don't look, we don't track, we don't think, we don't disaggregate data. So when you have the very broad grouping of Asian, there is a myth of the model minority, and typically Asians come out very high in educational scores. They come out very high in economic scores, they come out very high in being admitted to university scores, and yet within this group, there are over 20 different countries of origin, over 40 different ethnic and cultural groups, and over 200 languages and dialects, and we have elected to group them under one name, Asian. So it's no wonder that we don't know who's missing, and we can't begin to implement or put things in place to address some of these inequities because we're having a hard time figuring it out. I also work on immunization inequities, and this exact same thing happens. As a group, Asians are the highest immunized group of children. And yet, when you disaggregate the data, you find all manner of patterns that we've been missing. So for those of you that aren't familiar, who are the Hmong? So at the end of the Vietnam-American War, refugees from the Highland Plains of Laos, there were at least 10 different ethnic groups from that region, but the majority of which were the Hmong, fled and came to the United States in Exodus and to Diaspora. The Hmong had served as a military arm of the United States military effort in Vietnam, and they built air bases in northern Laos, and we launched the secret war from there. So they trained in the United States, and I'm actually working on a nursing history project. We also trained nurses to work there that were young Hmong girls from the villages. So when we lost the Vietnam-American War, the Hmong people lost significantly. 60% of their male population was killed. Just think about that. And literally anybody and everybody that could leave their country went into Diaspora. So they were under a lot of distress by the time they arrived at different places in the world. However, we are 40 years later, and the Hmong have made many amazing adaptations, and you're going to see a Hmong physician speak here a little bit in this talk, and are a very diverse group based on the generation, but still the majority are refugee, first-generation refugee, and many still do not speak English, so there's a lot of work to be done. It's important to note that they're the fastest-growing by percentage minority group in California and the United States. When the Hmong arrived in the United States, they brought historical health beliefs that were actually quite different than any of those previously experienced by Western health care. And a lot of this was based on historic animist belief that souls exist everywhere. And each person has at least 3 to 7 souls, and that souls are present in many, many forms. And I had one of the best descriptions about this when there were the huge, horrific fires that were down in Los Angeles and San Diego. Do you remember they were like encroaching on the city of San Diego and fires were alight? California was on fire. And a Hmong shaman called me up and he said, "Diane, you have to do something. The Hmong shaman understand the soul of the fire. And they will put this fire out, but we need the government to ask them so that we can get into the spirit world and put these fires out." I thought, okay, I'm seeing that spirits, it's everywhere. Everything has a spirit. And he described very carefully that in Laos, they use slash and burn for agriculture. And they would start fires. They never put them out with water. In fact, they never put them out at all. They called on the spirit of the fire to put itself out, and the shaman held that power and considered themselves to be very successful. So I did call some legislators, and I did try to talk about this, and finally we just got together and with about 10 shamans, and fires went out the next week. I'm not going to say that that's the attributable cause, but I bring that to you by way of talking about how powerful and what these beliefs really mean. So the shaman come, they enter a spirit world, but it's important to note that about 40 to maybe 50% of the Hmong community do not practice animist beliefs and do not use shaman for health care. They have converted to Christianity and use Western health care very regularly. So if you did a survey and you said, you know, are you this, are you that, you know how you get asked if you're Protestant or Catholic or something, you know, they would put themselves, well, I'm Christian or I'm animist or I believe in shaman. But in reality, I find that it's a huge admixture. And those that are primarily shamanistic in their belief will seek out Western health care when they need to. And those that are considered highly Christian may hide it from their church because there are sometimes with some of the churches, it's like you can't belong to this church if you still believe that. They will hide it and they will seek out shamanism. So in the context of a refugee community that came under great duress, that had experienced horrific wartime culture, lost 60% of their male population, it's not hard to think that there's going to be a significant amount of disability in this community for a whole wide spectrum of things. And we didn't have numbers, we didn't have data, it wasn't being looked at. And so decided that we would sit and just talk about this issue, what was going on related to disability. So we used the United Nations framework. We looked at others. We looked at the ones that were available in the United States and our legal things, decided on that. And then we had to talk about translation and interpretation. So if you think about impairment, disability, and handicap, and yet you're going to try to find that one word, what's that one Hmong word that you're going to use to kind of wrap all these things around? And what does that mean? What's really the pragmatic translation? So I had my eyes wide open. I went to one of the UC Davis pediatric clinics, and we were talking about disability with a child. And the very appropriately, amazingly well-trained cultural translators and interpreters at UC Davis and disabilities. And one of the sister of the client was there. And so we walked out and she goes, you know, I wish you guys would get over this. And I said, get over what? Calling my sister stupid. I said, oh, no one called your sister stupid. Oh my gosh. Well, that's the translated term. And it turned out in Hmong, there's one universal word that means disability of all types. There isn't words for Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or any of the other medical jargon that we throw about. The one universal word was stupid. No idea. And our cultural Bulker translator was doing a very good job of taking the word disability and Down syndrome and cerebral palsy and putting it right into Hmong for us. So ask, listen, and translate, and I'll talk a little bit more about translation processes as well. So we use community-based participatory research, and this is just a fancy word for what the disability community has been saying for decades. Nothing about us without us. So operationalizing participatory action and not researching but moving to action and using social change as part of the work of our knowledge community and the research community is really what community-based participatory action does. This work was based on Carl Lewin and Paulo Freire, and I put these in only for those of you that want to do more of a deep dig, that this is a good place to start. It's participatory, cooperative, engaging, co-learning, systems-driven, capacity-building, empowering, and very importantly, imbalances research with action. Work with rather than in the community. Now, there are some big barriers because National Institute of Health likes to fund you for a year or two. The state, a lot of the grants are 1 year long. I mean, you can barely start the conversation about your values and frameworks and what the issues are and gather the data before your grant fundings run out. So we have a research-driving agenda that wants quick, 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 action, 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 get us the data, get us the stuff. And you have a community that's saying, no, no, no. We want changes. We want results. We want our efforts to be more than that. And often these systems conflict. It's important to remember that the community is the unit of identity, not the research agenda. That you always start by looking at the community strengths. And that all phases of the research are collaborative, equitable, and in partnership. And this means particularly that the researcher does not go in with the NIH grant funding thing of the month, that you're actually looking at things that the community wants to look at. And I had an example of this about 6 years ago. Kaiser Permanente had grants to look at childhood obesity. And obesity is a significant issue among Hmong children. So I was like, oh, yay, here we go. Here's money. Here's the Hmong community. There's an issue. Here I come. We have the meeting. And they said, oh, no, thank you. No, not interested in that. Oh, really? Wow, it's a lot of money. Come on. No, you didn't ask us what's going on with our kids. Oh, what's going on with your kids? Well, 22 of them were killed in gang violence last year. We want to talk about obesity. We want to talk about that. So back the money went to Kaiser, and an application went out to the California Endowment, and we spent about 3 years addressing youth violence in the Hmong community, and I'm proud to tell you there were no deaths over the last 3 years. Then I could go back and say, now about this obesity thing, and they said, okay, that's good. We can talk about that now. But you have to listen to the community. Everything is co-learning and research and action, which I've emphasized, and it has to be local issues. Ongoing cyclic process, a lot of feedback loops, lots of conversations, a lot of repeating. When you work with a community, you're going to have people come and go. Energies come and go. Leaders come and go. Somebody's there today, they might disappear for 18 months, they might go back to Laos, and then they're going to be back again. So some repeating. So we started this community-based participatory research process, Nothing About Us Without Us, with this group of people. You can see me in the middle there. We formed in 2008, again with impetus and funding from the SED, and our initial dream and vision was to address social stigma and lack of awareness in the Hmong community about disabilities and the potential for persons with disabilities. We also knew that we had to enhance healthcare providers' cultural knowledge, and I gave an example about, I don't know how many years it had been going on, where we were referring to disabilities with an inappropriate term through what we thought were really good and well-meaning translators. So the first step is we had to expand our CBPR team, and we needed to include Hmong community members and families experiencing developmental disabilities firsthand. We also added people from the healthcare side and educational side, and we worked with Hmong Women's Heritage Association, a local private nonprofit. It was founded by Mi Ying Lee. Some of you may be familiar with her work. She was the cultural broker in The Spirit Catches You, You Fall Down. And she started this fantastic organization to support the Hmong community. All of these members were Hmong, of Hmong origin. And eventually our team, I took this picture, so our team expanded to include this group. So now we have a lot of people working on an issue, so that's a lot to listen and make sure everybody's voice gets heard. But we got it done. We decided we needed to know more about the Hmong's community perception of developmental disabilities and also their view of support services. So first, we had to determine some issues around causality because cultures, ethnic groups, families, and an individual person will determine causality for most things in their life. It could even be as much as, you ever watch people watch the Super Bowl and you say something, go, don't jinx it. You know, we think we have a lot of power. We have a lot of causality for almost everything that we do, and this certainly isn't any different. Why it's important to determine causality is because that is very closely related to how you view your potential, how you view the uptake of services, and how you view what you think the medical community can do for you. And I think this is a really important first question and part of functional assessment for anybody that walks in for healthcare. What do you think causes your health? What were the cultural attitudes toward people with disabilities? How are people with disabilities treated in general in the Hmong community? What were the language descriptions in use? And that was hours and hours and hours trying to get that teased out. And then what are the stories and mythologies? Are there any stories of heroes that have disabilities? If you remember the spirit catches you, you fall down. Leah, the young girl that had a seizure disorder within that community, means that you have potential to become a shaman. So it's actually quite an honor. Causality in disabilities varies worldwide, and it varies within communities, and it varies within a person, and it varies within a person over the course of their lifespan. So this isn't a question you get to ask just once. But there are thoughts about causality that relate to traditional animism, which is taboo and punishment, and I'll give you some examples that describe this pretty clearly in the Hmong community. Divine intervention, it's simply God's will. There's a witchcraft, there's a spirit, something happened, it invaded my body. And then there's medical deterministic belief, where we say it's within the human physiology, it's a genetic thing, something like that. As part of our research methodology, we used an exploratory qualitative focus group method. We use Kurpatov thematic analysis to help us interpret the data that we received. And we used Hmong Women's Heritage Association as cultural brokers. We had 10 key informant interviews, and we did a focus group with them as well. And then we had persons with developmental disabilities and family members across the lifespan and across spectrum of disability. All of our key informants were of Hmong origin. And ultimately, we decided to use Healthy People 2020 to help overarch the driving goals. And this nice model wasn't available when we started our work, but we knew it was coming. And this is looking at social determinants of health. And this is a model that says that a person's individual traits, such as age, sex, race, interact with biological factors that are then influenced by individual behavior, family and community, living and working conditions, and then the broad-based social, economic, cultural, health, and environmental issues. And more importantly, these things occur across a lifespan, and that these are things that determine health. So it does include spiritual belief, religious belief, things from the environment. It's a very much that interactional model that I mentioned early on in the talk. So when we looked at what people told us, we tried to fit it into sort of a cultural individual perspective, and then what were the things structurally about the environment that were creating barriers or perceptions. So we found out that there was a fairly strong theme in the Hmong community that accepting governmental services is inappropriate. It's just not the right thing to do. Ever. Particularly if it's something your family can take care of. Now, my father grew up in Indiana. He was born in 1914. And I would say if he told me 100 times, he told me 1,000 times, there's one thing you do, Miss Diane, you will never go on welfare and you will never take money from the government because that would shame our family. And you're going to college and you're doing this and you're doing that. So I thought, wow, I really get that. That was something I got brought up with. But that's not necessarily everybody's belief. I mean, there's a lot. That's kind of a very far cry from a very socialistic kind of thing where we all pool our money and we all take care of each other. But it was very strong for them. There were a lot of structural barriers, a lot of lack of accurate information, information that was understandable, that had clear meaning, language, transportation, which I think are some of the things we're more familiar with, lack of trust, lack of outreach, and all these factors interfered with acceptance, identification, and utilization of services. So let me give you some quotes which kind of further explain. So I think there's a lot of stigma around it in the families who do have family members with a disability. They're really protective of that individual, and they try to shelter that individual because they're afraid of the stigma about, you know, is attached to the family name. So what we heard is that if a person had a physically discernible disability, they were not brought out into public. They did not attend Long New Year's, they did not go to church, and they were left at home. Because if the community realized that this disability was in the family, that no one in the family would be marriageable. So it had a big impact. It's huge amounts of social stigma. I understand where this developmental disability came about, and the doctors can't do anything about it because it's something that I did. So therefore, I'm going to just keep it the way it is, and I think that the beliefs kind of prevent the families from seeking help. So this person said something that I did. So when she was a young girl, about 10 or 12 years old, there was a child with a clear disability, and she made fun of that child. She has two children with autism, the mom that said this. She said, the reason why I have these two children with autism is because I made fun of those kids when I was young, and that was mean, and the spirits are punishing me. And there's not anything anybody can do to make my kids better. A lot of difficulty accepting services. Well, I think it has a lot to do with cultural belief as well. I just wanted to second what he said. It has to do with truly believing that it's something you've done in a previous life or that you've done that was, you know, the ideal thing. It's my duty now to take care of it so it's not anybody else's. So the man that she's reflecting on had said that he had a child with a disability because he didn't sign up for military service in Vietnam and he stayed in his village. He kind of hid and he was guilt-ridden about this to this day. He had a child with a severe disability. And he is absolutely, within his core value, believes that he will carry this responsibility 100% on his shoulders. And if he even lets anybody change a diaper, that this will never disappear from his family, and every future family generation will be inflicted with this exact same disability. Well, this is even going back to attribution of action and war. Communication barriers. Because of language barriers, I won't be able to help my child. Even if mails about the agency that help people with disability comes, I wouldn't be able to read it to know that there are places that can help. So we heard this over and over again. Lots of mailings coming out in English, and they throw it away. And how often do we do that? The California state requires that we send things out in the top 8 languages. That hardly ever happens anyway. And certainly Hmong is not among one of those. So one of the suggestions they came up, and I really like this one, I hope all of you will think about it, is because the cost of translation is so expensive. I mean, that's a structural reality that we live with. So they just have a set of stickers that says, important information about your child, please have someone translate. They just put it right on the outside of the envelope. I'm sure it doesn't work 100% of the time, but it certainly makes things a lot better, and it was a suggestion directly from the community. I know that my child goes to a special school because a special bus comes every morning to take her child to school, but I have no idea what kind of school it is and what kind of services school is providing my child because I do not speak or understand English and I have no way of communicating with the school staff. This is a theme that we heard over and over and over again. Somebody comes and picks my child up, something happens to them, and then I get my child back and no idea what's going on. Trying to understand what the disability is. I mean, I've gone to IEP meetings and the families are like, this is, you know, it's like they're here to actually, you know, create the plan already. And the families all, I don't even know what the disability my child has. So, you know, they just say sign the IEP. Just sign the IEP. Heard this story numerous times. I actually had one parent tell me that the IEP came in the mail and she recognized the school district logo, so she decided not to throw it away and had her high school son read it, and it was the whole IEP plan with a big arrow saying, have sign here. So she signed it and her son took it back to school. No clue in between. Now, Do I realize that those are violations of the intent of the law and our best efforts and all the amazing people we have working in schools and everywhere? Absolutely. But these are systematic issues. No one individual is responsible for any of these stories I'm telling you. Families didn't know about existing resources. They weren't sure what's available. They didn't even know how to ask for what might be available. What is the child receiving at school? What is special education? Now, we talked about disability and the word stupid, inappropriate word of stupid in translation. So you can imagine now what has happened in sometimes the translation. Stupid school. It's a little scary. Lack of understanding details of diagnosis. And again, this is just an exemplar because what I'm talking about in the Hmong community goes on in many of the communities in California. But a lot of the medical words that we use, there really is just no word. So if you're not taking those very forward steps of working with your interpreter beforehand and saying, here's these words, here's these things, now tell me what these words mean, and even doing back translation, you're not going to necessarily know what you've just said to your patient. So family members, limited social support, it's just not other people's responsibilities. And this, I think, is I've heard universally, there will be no one else to care for my child when I die. Unable to communicate with school staff, special education personnel, medical personnel, unable to read materials. Some structural issues, which I think have come up with a lot of healthcare disparities or transportation and lack of insurance. But one thing that's unique about the Hmong is that in 1996, President Clinton recognized the service that they gave during the Vietnam-American War and actually gave them lifetime Medicare benefits. So compared to almost all the other refugee and immigrant communities in California, the Hmong are highly insured, up to 86%, which beats almost every other group. So all these things are happening and lack of access, despite that in general they're very highly insured. It's a very dichotomous thing because we always think that insurance is the cure. I mean, right now, the whole healthcare reform, let's just get everybody insured and these problems are going to go away. And this is a very strong case in point that that just simply is not the case. So we talked about what to do. So there was a strong desire to dispel myths about developmental disabilities and to learn more, that the Hmong could see that there are persons with wheelchairs in grocery stores. They could see all kinds of things going on around them. And so how do we begin to dispel the myths within our own community? We talked with the shaman quite a bit about this. And with very rare exception, this is what I heard. I am the person that deals with the spirit, the soul, that thing within the fire. And the Western healthcare providers deal with some of the physical aspects of the body. And together, we make a pretty great team. There very much wasn't this, gee, if you see the shaman, you shouldn't see the Western healthcare provider. And many of them have told me they send their clients for immunizations. One man had just done a ritualistic ceremony for a young child with Down syndrome. And he asked the parents, have you been to the doctor? And he said, no, you got to go to the doctor. I'm not doing the ceremony until you go see the doctor. So I think there's much more potential for partnership than perhaps we've discussed. And then having interpreters, web pages, things that are resources to the community. Many of the things I've suggested, particularly regarding interpreters and translators, are going to require more time during a healthcare visit. I'm a nurse practitioner. You get 10 minutes. You got to see so many patients in an hour. How are you going to get this done? Then you've got to have this pre-conversation. And it's almost mind-boggling. But until we begin some advocacy about this, we're not going to get it corrected. We have not yet done this, but I would love to set up a home visit or nurse hotline so that families could immediately ask questions in language in a culturally specific way, particularly for disabilities and very complex health conditions. I said that community-based participatory research wasn't about just finding out. And many times when we do research from the university, this is where we leave. Now that we know all this, thank you. Bye. We get it published and off we go to our next grant. But I get to work for the SED, so I didn't have to do something in 2 to 3 years, and we could really stay and move our findings into action. Very honored to have that privilege. So we set up a program to do social marketing and to take advantage of what we've learned about social marketing and health communication. And for those of you that aren't familiar with social marketing, this happens to you all the time. And this is just taking the same exact principles by where they sell you a Coca-Cola or do product placement in those fancy Hollywood movies to get you to buy something, to get that new Prius, because, you know, my old Prius only gets 44 miles per hour, but now I'm here and they're getting 50. Better get out and buy that new one. So it's just marketing, 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 trying to get you to buy and change. So we use social marketing to get people to change their healthcare behaviors. And you guys are probably familiar with some of these campaigns. Click it or ticket. No texting while driving. You know, these kind of slogans that are saying change your healthcare behavior. I just was looking at one about aging because we have many more sexually transmitted infections occurring in the aging population. And I turned a magazine page and it said, age is not a condom. And it was put out by the Center for Disease Control, you know, trying to get people to really change their healthcare behaviors. So that's what we decided to do, that we would launch a social marketing campaign to create hope, to create awareness, and to create linkages for services. So here's our team. We researched the issue, we tried to explore solutions, and then we needed to figure out what the strategies were. So what were the channels, what were the types of communication that we wanted to do, what were the products that we wanted to have. One thing I found out, brochures, pretty much a waste of time. Actually, turns out that all those health brochures that we pass out at healthcare visits, I probably have a stack meaningless, don't bother. Very few people ever look at them, and the ones that look at them didn't need them to begin with. So you have to find some other things to do. If you want more information about health communication and social marketing, a really good website down at the bottom is CDC Synergy, and it'll explain these aspects of social marketing and how to really kind of draw attention and launch into the community. Just a little bit about the research. We went back to the table and did focus groups, but this time we were talking about how do we launch a campaign? How do we do social marketing in the Hmong community? We developed messaging, and then we pair-tested it to see if it was effective in getting to our goals. Our campaign included posters, flyers, radio, TV, and booths at community events. The flyers that we use were basically just announcement about the radio and TV shows, so trying to get people hooked up to that. Now, one of the really wonderful strengths of working with the Hmong community is they have an amazing network through Hmong radio, and pretty much everybody listens to Hmong radio. So if you want to get something out there, if you can get on Hmong radio, it's going to get out. There's also a TV station, Crossing TV. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's in all over the Central Valley, New York, many places on the East Coast. And Crossing TV's mission is to provide TV programming for the other 60%. So the 40% of Californians speak English or Spanish as a first language. 60% do not. So if you're thinking of only English and Spanish, you're missing a lot of groups. And Crossing TV does program for that. So they have a lot of cultural programming, special events, things like that. They were very kind, and they gave us in-kind matching. Now, at this point in time, I wrote a few other grants, so I had some funding to pay for the marketing campaign. And then we worked with Hmong Radio. So we developed some TV PSAs. We did a half-hour TV show. We did radio. And these radio announcements went over the course of 6 months. We had them on about every half hour during that time. And we put out calendars and then flyers and posters we hung in markets, ethnic community Hmong markets, to talk about when we were going to be on the radio and the TV. We had calendars. Now, the Hmong are traditionally a very agrarian culture, so calendaring and the pace of the year is quite important in their culture. And I don't think I have ever visited a Hmong home that doesn't have several calendars on the wall. So very important, this organization of calendaring. I'll show you the calendar we did. We also got Dr. Robin Hansen, who greeted you this morning, to go on Hmong Radio and do a Q&A with families with an interpreter. And we kept our time slot, and we were lucky because we got the number one listened to show. I don't know what that would be the equivalent of, and maybe KCRA or something. But so this is the calendar. We did it in two different dialects in Hmong. There is Green Hmong and White Hmong. That's another important thing to know with your interpreters and translators. We had children and dress them up in traditional Hmong outfit. We were told quite clearly, if you want someone who's Hmong to look at something, then they have to be dressed like Hmong. Kind of made perfect sense. And of course, who doesn't want to look at kids? Because they're just the best thing ever. And they selected this slogan: harvesting is preparation for hunger. Raising children is preparation for the future. If your child has a developmental disability, we can help. Please call the following agencies. And then they're listed down at the bottom. And this is up all year in every Hmong house that we could get it into. We did 5,000 of these, half in White Hmong, half in Green Hmong. Half of them were pink, half of them were green. And I still see them in homes today. We did another series for 2012. So what happened? We were able to market and co-locate services. We got an Alta Regional Center Hmong speaking social worker located at Hmong Women, so out of the government building. That was a big step. He was seeing an average of 3 new clients per month when they would see 3 per year. So really improved our outreach. We did some post-campaign focus groups to find out sort of what chatter was going on. We monitored the radio call-in. I think Robin took 10 questions the day she was there, so we knew people were listening, calling in, asking questions. And we had a website linkage to Regional Center in UC Davis for services. Now, the downside of all of this is since we launched this campaign and began to improve services, we did some IEP meetings, some trainings, we worked with some healthcare providers, we did some other things. The budget has crashed and burned, as you well know. Hmong Women's lost several of their support staff. They moved into a much smaller building. Alta Regional Center got way cut back. Matthew Banks no longer to be out into the community. I mean, it just... it was a very frustrating, challenging, and difficult time for us all. But it doesn't mean that we're going to stop. We still have the tapes and the videos and the outreach materials and many ways of moving forward. But the idea of doing the research, creating the social marketing, and then really changing services was our dream. And it's this part about changing services that's become quite frustrating in contemporary times. But we're not stopping. So what did we find out? If you're going to close the gap, you have to look for marginalized communities. You have to understand the over 60 cultures and well over 109, some people say up to 200 languages. We have a very complex system in California. The word bicultural never should be used again. It just doesn't even capture what we need to do. You have to know your community, know your demographics. You have to look for data. We're really fortunate. We have at least 2 school districts in Sacramento County that actually collect disaggregated Asian data. Now, there are a lot more than 2 school districts, but it's a start. We're getting there. Alta Regional Center collects disaggregated Asian data. So how fortunate we were to be able to actually look at the issues. Listen to the stories and know that your cultural broker, your interpreter, has to be much more than a typical interpreter or a cultural broker. They have to understand the world and complexity of disabilities. They have to understand the world and complexity of the culture, their native culture, and they have to understand the world and complexities of the Western healthcare system. That's a lot. And what are the infrastructures and support and resources that we're putting into developing cultural brokers that can help us with care and services? Look, listen, observe, learn, work together, ask questions, language and meaning is important. Start there. Be prepared for time and commitment. Always ask yourself, who is missing? This is one of our family outreach events that we did. Thank you.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.